This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
8:15 now. As you all know, the amendments, all four amendments that were put up for the voters on Saturday's election, were defeated resoundingly. And we wanted to get another political scientist's thoughts on what happened and why and what happens from here. Pearson Cross joins us, our friend, professor of political science at ULM. How you doing, doctor, professor?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Pearson, let's go with Pearson.
Any of the above.
How about
works
PC?
Just fine.
How about PC? I'll call you PC.
Yeah, I like that.
All right, PC.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about the amendments themselves. First of all, as a political scientist, did it have to do? What did you infer from the results? I'll start there.
Yeah, some people have been inferring that it's a big defeat for Jeff Landry, and it is a setback. But really, I think the amendments lost on their own without Jeff Landry's help. You know, I mean, I think voters were making a statement about too much too soon and overreaching. And I think Amendment 2 kind of sums all that up.
Pearson, I apologize to you. I clumsily disconnected my headphones and I didn't hear a word of what you said. I'm just being honest. Can you tell me again, please?
Sure. Yeah, I didn't see it as a referendum on Governor Jeff Landry. I saw it instead as a true expression of voter sentiment, which was that, particularly in Amendment 2, it was too much too soon. It was too hard to digest. There were groups, from the far left and the far right against this. It's unusual when you get a coalition like that opposing something. And the governor perhaps could have done a slightly better job of publicizing it. But really, the fault was in the creation.
Let me ask you about that a little bit, because it seems to me, and the way, you know, I talked to God knows how many people about this before, and when it comes to Amendment number 2 specifically, I characterized it as there is so much in here. There are so many consequences, both intended and unintended. Basically, this comes down to, and everybody that was in for it said, yes, it comes down to, trust me, this is the best thing for the state. Would that be accurate or not?
Yeah, I think that's really accurate, because there were so many moving parts. I mean, the bill was 115 pages long, and then to ask voters just to read a small paragraph, because we know voters aren't going to read the bill, so read just a small paragraph, really just like 1.5 sentences, and then make a decision about something that momentous, it was just too much to ask people to do.
So does that, if that's the case, then, if it was about trust me, can we infer from that the voting public was saying, nah, I don't completely trust y'all? Not necessarily the governor, the legislature, the entire Louisiana government when it comes to revising so many things in the state constitution.
Well, we know that trust in government is at a historic low. But, you know, this is not unusual. There have been 325 amendments proposed since 1974. 221 of those have passed, so over 100 have been shot down. So it's not particularly unusual. There were some Trump effects on this one. I think there was an unusually high outpouring of people who said, this is my first chance to say no to something since Donald Trump got elected. And I think so you saw some of that as well, I believe.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about that, because Louisiana overwhelmingly went for Trump in the presidential election, correct?
That's correct.
So when it comes to turnout, do we know yet if it was people that either didn't vote in the presidential election, didn't vote for, well, we wouldn't know who voted for Trump or not, Trump voters? What I'm trying to say is, did this motivate the anti-Trump base to come out, or does it reflect in any way perhaps dissatisfaction with Trump voters with what they've seen so far, or neither? I don't know. Tell me.
Yeah, well, I would say, first of all, turnout was around 21%, although it varies by parish. You know, in some places, you know, there are chronic voters who came out in this election. Those are people who vote every time, and those would be across the spectrum, you know, Republican and Democrat. Now, the Amendment 2 went down to a crushing defeat in Orleans Parish, 73,000 to 7,000. So it had 91% no's. So I think you would expect to see, well, that's kind of a partisan outcome there in a place we would expect it. Mm-hmm. What we wouldn't expect is that in Ouachita Parish, where I live, you know, there was about a 60-40 split on no's as well, you know, which is an area that's very strong Trump country. So I think this really says more about the amendment than it says about larger effects.
Did the let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Pearson Cross, professor of political science at ULM. By the way, Pearson, my kid lives in Ruston, which is very close to Monroe, as you well know.
Of course.
That's a beautiful area of the country. It really is, of the state. Both Monroe and West Monroe, if y'all have not been, and even Ruston, you need to go and take a trip because it's a beautiful area to just visit. 820 traffic now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Pearson Cross, professor of political science at ULM. We already talked about Amendment Number 2. Did all of the amendments, Pearson, go down by the same amount in the same areas, or was there was it different? That's what I was trying to say. Was it different?
Yeah, no, they did. So it's really amazing. So Amendment 1 went down 65-35. Amendment 2, 65-35. Amendment 3, 66-34. Amendment 4, 64-36. I mean, they're all right in the same ballpark. So voters didn't like all of them.
Is it all like eating potato chips when it comes to voting no to amendments? And I'm not trying to be silly when I say that. Is it I don't like this and I'm just going to vote. I think this is a bad amendment. I don't like it. So I'm just going to, while I'm going, I'm going to vote against them all.
That could be it. You know, voters in the past have shown, like, for example, in 1970 or 1974, voters went to the ballot and were asked to choose to vote on 50 constitutional amendments, and they voted them all down. And I think that was just a general revulsion of the public of just like, why are you making us do this? And so I think there was some of that. I think people are tired of these amendments, you know, election after election.
Are voters, other than chronic voters, savvy enough to sense like when an amendment is put on an obscure election date like March 29th, to think that maybe there's some chicanery going on?
Yeah, that could be part of it. But you know, to understand that, they would have to get out and vote, and mm-hmm. the only people who do that really are the chronic voters. So, you know, the chronic voters basically said no, and with perhaps a smattering of people who were, you know, upset about other issues. But what was interesting on this was that you had people like Tony Spell and Woody Jenkins against mm-hmm. too, at the same time that you had Louisiana Budget Authority, far left group against too as well. So, you know, this was across the spectrum, just thinking some of these things are bad ideas.
So for those that don't like Governor Landry, they think this was a slap in the face, that he expended a lot of political capital. For those that don't, that do like him, they say that's not the case at all. What is it, the truth politically, when it comes to political capital and who won, who lost here, and what happens going into the session?
Well, I would be reluctant to state this is the truth politically, but from my point of view, Landry lost some capital on this one. I mean, he's been riding high. He's had some special sessions. He's had very successful legislative sessions. He's, you know, got a supermajority in both House and Senate. So he's doing really well, but you can't construe this any other way than kind of a slap in the face and a caution to him not to get ahead of the voters.
And what about the other legislators? I know I saw my friend Pat Connick, say that they had to, I know he was a strong proponent of this, Amendment Number 2, and said that they had to change the way that we do business in the state. He said on the news yesterday, I think talking to a reporter at Channel 4, that they would have to do something. What happens now in the legislature as far as either revisiting this or changing it some type of way?
Oh, I definitely think we're in a, you know, fiscal, so we're in an odd year, so we have a fiscal session. So I think the defeat of two is going to mean that this is front and center for the legislature. They're going to try to take a number of other swings at this apple. I imagine they'll do what they can with legislation, and then maybe they'll find a way to spin off a few of these discrete parts that they think are particularly important, like the income tax part, for example, or the education trust fund part, into separate constitutional amendments that voters can digest a bit more easily.
But it all has to be done by amendment and put before the voters. It can't be done just with a legislative action, right?
Much of it. You know, the key here is if it's already in the Constitution, the only way you can change it is by making constitutional amendment. If it's not in the Constitution, then legislation works just fine.
As far as, and we got to go here, I'm a second late, and they get mad at me when I ask a question, but if you can give me a 20-second answer, was there
sure.
a lot of left opposition to this? Because I didn't hear that much. I don't know. Was this about the campaigning? Would that have made a difference with Governor Landry getting ahead of it or behind it?
No, I think there was some left opposition, you know, based on some of the questions about what it would do to education or and changes to the income tax structure. But I didn't hear that much. But there was broad opposition to it, more than just from left or right.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Pearson Cross, ULM. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Keith Spear about Jazz Fest. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:46, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Tim Zimmer, Manning Master Control, tells me, so I'm attributing this to him, that they've also changed the rule where teams can wear alternative uniforms four times a season. Is that at home, on the road, or I guess anywhere? It depends on what the other team is wearing, though, because of the colors, etc. Keith Spear joins us now, and as the NFL owners meet, we'll continue to keep you updated. As far as any changes that they approve. Keith Spear, a reporter for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate. How are you?
I'm good, Tommy. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, sir. Let's talk about the Jazz Fest cubes that came out. I don't know, with everything going on last week, a lot of it got lost, I guess, maybe with weather or whatever it was. But tell me your thoughts on the cubes and the days you're looking forward to most.
Well, yeah, you know, you don't really get a true picture of the festival's personality until you look at the cubes. You know, the raw list of names that comes out in January only tells you so much. You've really got to look and see who's following who on which stage to really get a sense of the festival. And yeah, look, it's a really interesting year. You know, I mean, you've got one day where the main festival stage, you know, is essentially programmed like the Congo Square stage. You got Lil Wayne and the Roots headlining it. You got Big Frieda on that stage, Tank and the Bangas. So that's really interesting. You know, they've rarely showcased hip hop on the main stage. So to see, you know, the hometown rapper Lil Wayne headline that day will be interesting on the first Saturday. Excuse me. They've got 2 days instead of one where you've got a major country headliner on the main stage. That's both of the Fridays with Casey Musgraves and Luke Combs. So I don't recall a year when you had two country headliners on the main stage like that before. You know, and then back to that first Saturday, It's a great dichotomy where you've got Lil Wayne headlining the festival stage and Harry Connick Jr. headlining the Gentilly stage at the same time. So two very different New Orleans musicians at opposite ends of the fairground headlining on that day.
So it does kind of go to... Well, for I guess the diverse nature of New Orleans music, but also I think it goes to not just the diversity of the Jazz Fest, but how music is changing and how the fest is kind of evolving with it. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I think so. You know,
not that Lil Wayne is a new artist or anything, but you understand what I'm saying.
Well, right. I mean, but, you know, it's just kind of funny. They've never actually had Lil Wayne out there. And I'm sure that was partly on his end. I mean, his scheduling and, you know, he doesn't live here anymore. He's based in Miami these days. So, but yeah, they finally got him, you know, I mean, he's been a major figure in hip hop for 20 years now, and they finally got him in a headlining spot. Yeah. And I think they've tried they're trying to mix up the presentation a little bit more. You know, in 2024, they had Anderson .Paak and the Free Nationals, which is a band that certainly has a lot of hip-hop content to it. They headlined on the festival stage. So they've been moving in this direction a little bit, and this is just the latest iteration of that evolution, I'd say.
Newell Norman just texted me, Lil Weezy, not Lil Wayne. All right, Wayne. Newell, thank you for that. Thank you for that correction. I appreciate
Newell
it.
Newell knows what's up. He does.
He does. Newell texting me, fixing that. Let me take a break, Keith. We'll pick it up when we come back. I want to talk about some of the acts for different genres, different people that are looking for different things, be it classic rock, be it traditional, maybe jazz or New Orleans music, oldies, anything. We'll talk about that more when we come back. 8:50, 10 till 9, talking Jazz Fest, Cubes with Keith Speary. He'll be here before you know it. We're into April, April 1st today, and the first day of Jazz Fest, Thursday, April 24th. Traffic now, WWL. 8:56, 4 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to our friend Keith Spira, who is the reporter for Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, about Jazz Fest and the cubes that have come out. What about some classic rock acts, some traditional Jazz Fest artists, et cetera, Keith?
Well, sure. They had a lot of success last year by booking Heart on the Gentilly stage. So this year you've got two similar kind of, you know, late 70s, early 80s FM radio rock bands. You've got Cheap Trick out there, and you've got Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. So they're kind of scratching that same classic rock itch by having those guys out there again. Look, as far as jazz, contemporary jazz, they've got a lot of the big names in contemporary jazz headlining at the Jazz Tent. You've got Joshua Redman. You've got Brantford Marsalis, who moved back to New Orleans last year and is going to be playing out there with his quartet. You've got Yellow Jackets. You've got Stanley Clark, the great guitar player. You've got Diana Krall, the piano player and singer. So it's a really strong contemporary jazz lineup out there this year.
Can you break it down by day? And is there one day that would lend itself more to one aficionado of one type of music?
You know, it's so mixed up. I mean, as we said earlier, if you're a country fan, you want to go on either of the two Fridays. If you want to take advantage of, you know, one of the best deals in popular music, buy yourself a $50 ticket on either of the Thursdays, because there's a little bit of everything on each of those Thursdays. Every day is pretty consistent across the genres, I would say. It just depends on which of the big bands you're a fan of. If you're a Dave Matthews Band fan, you go on the first Sunday. If you're a Pearl Jam fan, you go on the second Saturday. But, you know, the crazy thing about the Cubes, too, is you see all the tough choices that you have to make. And it's just, it's just crazy, some of the options that you have. On the last Sunday, the final slot, Trombone Shorty, New Orleans Avenue, My Morning Jacket, Patti LaBelle, Kamasi Washington, Chris Stone, Kingfish Ingram, Kermit Ruffin's tribute to Louis Armstrong, Marty Stewart, all at the same time. So that's that's a hard choice to make right there.
You know, when you talk about choices, it got me to thinking, Keith, about, is it science? Is it art? Is there any kind of focus group, any kind of research, any kind of numbers, any kind of math, science, et cetera, when it comes to evaluating one year's festival as it relates to booking the next year's festival, or how far in advance do some of these bookings take place? Do you know?
Well, they're booking some of these folks a year out at least. Mm-hmm. Some of the bigger acts plan, tours 1-2 years in advance. So, yeah, some of them were penciled in probably by the time last year's festival was taking place. I think at this point there is sort of a formula. They know they need, X many arena level rock bands. They know they need X many, major contemporary R&B bands. They know they need, X many jazz acts to fill the Jazz Tent. And they know that they're going to need, 400 plus Louisiana artists to fill out the rest of the schedule and give this festival its unique personality. So at this point, I mean, they know how many slots they have to fill. They know about what they want to spend. They know, roughly what ticket sales are going to generate, and all those numbers have to line up.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Keith. We'll talk to Jeff Nowak when we come back. WWL.